From WUWM and WUWM HD1 Milwaukee, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we talk with a key figure in Milwaukee's civil rights movement, Father Matthew Gottschalk, who remembers a formative trip down south in the 50s.
We got a kind of a picture of what society was drifting towards. We had no awareness that there was going to be all the riots and the violence and the successes.
Our monthly book segment introduces us to three new children's books by African-American authors. Plus, a filmmaker documents homelessness in Milwaukee's LGBTQ youth population.
I can't tell you how many times I'd come home from a shoot or after spending, you know, hours editing, just wishing I could do more. But I also realized the value of the story getting out there holds the potential to do a lot more than I could.
And we'll learn about the Milwaukee half of the pop duo Chester French. Lake Effect comes your way after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Demonstrations on both sides of the Wisconsin budget battle are continuing. For a generation of Wisconsinites, they represent the largest mass protests they've ever experienced. But older Wisconsinites remember a time that was equally, if not more, divisive when protests in places like Milwaukee came with an inherent risk of violence. It was the era of debate over civil rights and fair housing laws, and one of the central figures of that era was a Catholic priest named Father James Groppi. Groppi served as an advisor to the NAACP and led scores of demonstrations in the mid and late 60s. Among those who were influential in helping shape Groppi's views on inequity was another religious leader, a Capuchin friar named Matthew Gottschalk. Gottschalk was another pastor in the central city and co-founded the House of Peace in 1968. Gottschalk still serves in an advisory capacity there. He and Patrick Jones, author of the book Selma of the North, spoke on Milwaukee's civil rights history earlier this month, and they joined us in the studio beforehand. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having us.
Yep.
Father Gottschalk, how did, or maybe the better question is, why did you first get immersed in the civil rights movement in the 1960s?
Well, it's not too complicated. I was just a very young priest, ordained in 1953. They had to put me someplace. So they sent me down to St. Benedict the Moore Church in Milwaukee. And, of course, St. Benedict the Moore was a center for the Catholic black population at that time. So just spread from there.
Was it at all difficult for you to, at that place and time, grasp what this population was up against?
I would say not really. It was a great experience for me. I was teacher in a high school, assistant pastor, chaplain of the jail, which was a beginning of a cultural shock. And from there, just floated on.
Patrick Jones' book describes you as a mentor to Father Groppi, who many people know as one of the remarkable faces of civil rights here. Can you talk about how you worked with him, and was it evident early on to you how formidable a person he might be?
Well, I wouldn't use that adjective, but we met very early on. One of my jobs was working with the youth, and he volunteered to help at Father Stephen's Day Camp, which was a summer camp. And they'd have programs all day long, and then they'd go on trips up north to the cottages and so on. That was really delightful to get exposed, because some of the kids I taught at the school anyway. And I felt very comfortable. And he's a very warm person. Looking backward, maybe more complex than I thought he was, but we became very close friends. I wouldn't call myself a mentor, though.
Well, and Patrick Jones, you are nodding, and I'm hoping to get your sense for this.
Yeah, well, in my own research, I wasn't able to talk to Father Groppi because he passed away in the mid-1980s. But from talking to those around him, and including his wife later, Margaret Rosga, and also Patrick Flood, another young priest, seminarian and priest that worked with Father Matthew, you know, I think Father Matthew was an influential presence in their lives, and those experiences working in the inner core as seminarians and young priests did, I think, dramatically impact them. Father Pat Flood described that time in their lives and their engagement with the local black community as a conversion experience, something that opened their minds and their hearts and their understanding to the local community and what African Americans were facing. And Father Matthew, in addition to that summer camp, was instrumental in taking Father Grappi, Pat Flood, down south as well when the civil rights struggle really started to gain steam there, and to see firsthand what was happening in the South. Again, critical moments for Father Grappi, Pat Flood as well. And they came back, and it affected how they interacted with the community around them here. And Father Grappi, Father Flood, credited those experiences with really deepening their engagement with the civil rights movement here and catapulting them, in particular Father Grappi, later into a leading public role in the struggle here.
And Father Matthew, it must have been a critical moment for you as well.
Well, in many ways it was, but history is an interesting phenomenon. You don't know it's history until it's all over with, and you look back at it. And for example, my first assignment from summertime at Catherine June, Father Herbert, who was a pastor of St. Ben's, said, well, you make a door-to-door census of the Hillside Housing Project. And at that time, we had about five priests living there and only one car. So I would walk every day, walked every day to the Hillside Project, knocked on every door. And that was a exciting experience for me.
And Father Grappi and Flood accompanied you, I think, sometimes when you did house visits.
Yeah,
I don't know if that was different from the census,
but
they both talked about those house visits in the evening with Father Matthew and that giving them a deeper insight into African-American experience, the living conditions that many folks lived in here in the community, in the segregated inner core neighborhood as well. And again, just a very transformative experience for those young seminarians.
Well, and can you talk a little bit more about what you did on those house visits, those home visits?
Well, we're trying to find what the religious background was for the area. And there were some Catholics there, not a huge number, but people so friendly that somebody sit and talk. And so it was very revealing of their personal lives, of the struggles they have, and especially the interest they had in kids, because it's a project and they were family-oriented. So for me, I learned tremendous about human nature, about social conditions, and also about the hope that springs even from the darkest days.
Well, and you were saying that it's not history until you're looking at it in retrospect.
Right.
But obviously, that history must have informed your worldview today.
Well, it does. In fact, I was wanting to learn more. I like to read from way, way back to childhood. And after I was there about 2 or 3 years, I took a course at Marquette called Racial and Cultural Minorities. And from there, Father Austin Schlafer, who was pastor of St. Francis Church at that time, and we sat down and decided, well, we got to know where people are coming from, what their background is. So we made arrangements to make a trip through the South. At that time, it was segregation. And also in the Catholic Church, too. So we rode ahead. We contacted churches down there. And so we made a trip all the way through Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, which, again, was very, very rewarding because we met, like, the clergymen, the priests that were down there. We met some of the key people that were involved with justice at that time. That was right before the Civil Rights Act of 64. So we got a kind of a picture of what society was drifting towards. We had no awareness that there's going to be all the riots and the violence and the successes.
Patrick Jones, we have spoken before, but I don't know whether I've actually ever asked you this very simple question. Aside from seeking just to remember history, why do you think it is important to have this historical context to the civil rights movement in Milwaukee? Why is it important to understand this today?
Well, it's important locally because this is a critical dynamic of the local history. And Milwaukee, despite its urban renaissance in many ways, still suffers from gross inequality and concentrations of poverty and a whole host of social inequalities within urban communities of color. So the problem remains, despite the struggles and the achievement of the 1960s, of the civil rights era. And I think that this kind of history, we don't tell these northern movement stories. We tell the southern story in a kind of mythic sense as a redemptive story of democracy. But I think we don't tell these northern stories in some ways because it compels us or forces a confrontation with the present, with our shortcomings in the present, that we as a society, as a community of people, have yet to overcome the massive inequalities in not just Milwaukee, but this is a pattern that replicates itself in every middle and large size American city today. So I hope that this history, if we go back and are receptive to it and open to it, it might help us better understand how it is that we came to get where we are today. And that might help us if we're serious about thinking in more subtle ways about real solutions to problems.
Do you think there's a common misconception about the civil rights era in northern cities like Milwaukee, or is it simply an error of omission?
I think there's widespread ignorance of the struggle in the North, how race relations grew up and the unique dynamics of the urban North in particular, where there was large industrial economy, the presence of labor unions, the presence of tight-knit white ethnic communities, the presence of the Catholic Church, which is sizable and significant as a kind of mediating institution. There are unique dynamics. Race grows up within it. So we see racism and white supremacy, racial inequality in all regions, but it manifests itself in some different ways in the North. Where the movement in the North has entered the kind of popular narrative in the past is when black power emerges in the mid and late 60s, and there's the sense is that there's a radicalization, and often that story is told. The movement kind of goes off the rails in some negative directions. It becomes racially exclusive. It turns increasingly to violence, et cetera. We see images of race riots and things like that, not realizing that people in the North have been struggling for decades and decades prior to that, that some of those more extreme manifestations, which were amplified by the media oftentimes, that is not the full picture even in those moments, but that's a result of a long trail of frustration and dreams that have been deferred and beaten back year after year. And so, you know, we've seen a couple of little distorted snapshots in a story that places the Northern struggle in a very negative light overall. And so I'm part of a new generation of historians trying to press the way we think and look at the civil rights era beyond the South into the urban North and to try to bring more of that into light so that we might learn from this history.
I think it's a very good point because we can't underestimate the fact that Milwaukee inner city became a southern city in a northern climate because the black population had increased threefold in 1960s. It was 21,000 roughly in 1960 and 63,000 by the 1950 and 63,000 by the end of the decade. So.
And the rates of segregation in Milwaukee were comparable to places like Birmingham in the South. And so oftentimes folks that are outside of the South seem to think race and racial inequality or white supremacy were a regional problem. And in fact, it was a national problem. So we need to understand it in all of its manifestations, I think, and see it where it is and how it is.
I know your book details a march out to a judge's house in Wauwatosa that turned ugly in, I think it was 1966. Wauwatosa was recently the setting for some newer troubles with a racial undercurrent, and it's obviously not just Wauwatosa. There are issues around the region. I am curious to get both of your takes on this. Why do you think this is still a city that has trouble with race relations?
I'm going to look to experts to ask that. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Why have trouble with race relations all over the world? All the Sunnis and the Shiites and Israel and Palestine, it's universal. And I think the only sanctifying thing is we can continue struggling. And it says struggling, that's the point, not whether we achieve the goals.
There was not some fundamental misstep that happened in the 60s or 70s that left the door still open to this. You're saying this is just the problem of human nature.
Well, it's a manifestation of human nature itself, because there will always be hatred, ethnic, cultural, religious. You just study history. But on the other hand, I think the focal point or the hinge point was the so-called riot on July 30th, 1967. That brought it to the fore, made it public, and then it seeps into the consciousness of people. And once it's seeped into your consciousness and your attitudes and your emotional responses, that's when you're going to have problems.
I would put it like this. I mean, we have created this thing called race as human beings, and we have continued to create it and recreate it. It doesn't stop. It's a dynamic thing. And so the reality is we've continued to allow and to create through policy and choice and various kinds of actions a society, a city here in Milwaukee, and a society overall and throughout the world. We see these patterns as well, as Father Matthew said, one that is divided between people along certain lines, whether it's class, and race is one of those things. And we pour meaning into this thing we call race and what we call black and what we call white and what we call black spaces and white spaces and how we interpret why there are these inequalities. And so this has been going on a long time. The reality is we've continued to create it. we have not ever done the work to overcome the urban inequality that has been a fact of life since African Americans came in great numbers with the Great Migration. That is the struggle we have yet to fully ever overcome, and it has widened since the Civil Rights era. We have created new mechanisms that reinforce this and reinscribe those meanings into that space. And then overall, it is true, too, in the last 30 years or so, the industrial base that was the backbone of a city like Milwaukee has declined. The inner core overall has declined. We've seen the housing crisis that has hit cities and traditional neighborhoods and urban communities of color harder than anywhere else. And so people are scared and they're fearful.
Preacher Jones, you did a great job.
Thank you.
I just make a little footnote. I always believe that good can come out of evil. And you don't foster evil in order to get good out of it, but the simple fact is you do.
Well, Father Matthew Gottschalk and Patrick Jones, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Oh. Thank you.
Father Matthew Gottschalk is a Capuchin friar and co-founder of the House of Peace in Milwaukee and was a figure in Milwaukee's civil rights movement in the 1960s. Patrick Jones is an associate professor of history at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and author of The Selma of the North, Milwaukee's Civil Rights Insurgency, published by Harvard University Press. They spoke earlier this month at Milwaukee's St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church to mark Black History Month. This month also marks the annual African American Read-In, a national movement, but one which hasn't attracted a lot of local attention. There are efforts to change that. We'll hear more next on Lake Effect. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. We talk about books each month on Lake Effect with a local bookseller or librarian. This month, we're joined by Carla Allison, owner of the Reader's Choice Bookshop, which specializes in African-American authors and titles. She says that's also the specialty of the 22nd annual African-American Read-In, which the bookstore will mark this weekend. She says the program was started by the Black Caucus of the National Council of Teachers of English.
The purpose is, of course, to introduce people to and remind people of the variety of books that are written by African American authors. I'll tell you that in my bookstore, I am still, after 22 years there, I'm still surprised that every now and then people will come in and express surprise and, oh my God, you mean to tell me Black people wrote this many books? I didn't know. I had no idea that there would be this many books by African American authors. So I think the African American Read-In is a good way, a pleasant way to remind people that there are a variety of titles out there authored by Black Americans, and it's just a good activity for a family or a book club, so forth. We certainly want to encourage people to read.
Now, the read-in at the Reader's Choice is going to be especially on especially geared towards children's books.
Yes.
You have actually brought a couple of children's books along today that I was hoping we could talk about, starting with one that a lot of people have probably seen in bookstores but maybe haven't flipped through, especially if they don't have kids themselves, and that is President Obama has a children's book, and this is a picture book called Of Thee I Sing.
Yes, I think it's a beautiful book. It's a very simplistic book, and that's part of the beauty of it, I think, is the simplicity of it for people who are into reading, and particularly reading teachers. You'll recognize that every single page begins, have I told you that? You are. Have I told you that you are? And then he has selected a number of nouns and adjectives that exemplify a character that he sees in his daughters or he wants to enhance in his daughters to promote and so forth. And he connects that quality with a historical person. It's a very, very diverse book. And so some of the people are Native American. Some of the people are Black Americans. Some of the people are women. Have I told you that you are inspiring, for example? And here he has selected Cesar Chavez. The illustrations are beautiful. It's just a gorgeous book. It's large. It's simple to read. It's a picture book. And so I think young children will connect to the pictures.
This is of The I Sing, and we should note it's subtitled "A Letter to My Daughters," mm-hmm. and it's really as though it's being addressed to his daughters, and a good one to read aloud, I would say.
I think it's so typical of fathers. Maybe I'm judging by my own husband, who did not have a wealth of interaction with the kids when they were younger. But, you know, he's a great-grandfather now, and I think that's also kind of typical. In the younger years, I think fathers are very, very busy being the providers and that kind of thing. So I really connect with the president writing a book as simple as, "Have I told you that you are?" And just those simple words can mean so much to a little girl especially.
You've brought with you another children's book with maybe a similar theme, but there are some significant differences. And this mm-hmm. is the new book by Spike Lee and his wife, Tanya Lewis Lee.
Yes. As you said, it's similar. But I think the purpose of this one is to encourage children to persevere. I was reading a column in the paper just the other day about letting children fail, which we don't like to do. But the point, one of his points was, by letting children fail, you teach them that success comes from not necessarily talent, but from persevering. And so the book, Giant Steps to Change the World, by Spike Lee and his wife, Tanya Lewis Lee, is a book. Again, it's a picture book, gorgeous, gorgeous pictures, and it too connects historical people with their challenges. Harriet Tubman, Muhammad Ali, Mother Teresa, Albert Einstein, Tuskegee Airmen, and again, the focus here is to hang in there. Keep going. If this is what you believe in, if this is your dream, stick to it. No matter if you do fail the first time, get up and go back in. So certainly that's a lesson that we do want to teach our children, and they have put together a beautiful way to do that.
This is called The Giant Steps to Change the World. And you brought along one more children's book, and this is one of a slightly different theme. It's called The Beautiful Ballerina.
This is an amazing book. It's incredibly beautiful. Now, the difference between this book and the other two, just in how they're put together, is Beautiful Ballerinas is actually a picture book that offers live photographs. It's not illustrations. It's live photographs. And again, the beauty of it is they show black girls of all ages, all complexions, and they're all in their little tutus, looking as gorgeous as can be. It's pictures set against a poem. The pictures and the poses correspond to the poetry. So I think that's one to that every child, especially every little girl, should take a look at.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We mentioned African-American Read-In earlier in the interview, and this month is also Black History Month, and I wanted to ask you about a particular section of your bookstore. It's an area you define as Black Classics, and I was hoping that you could define it for us.
Well, I have written my own definition of a Black Classics, and I'm going to read it, if that's okay.
Sure.
The Black Classics are those books authored by African Americans with the express purpose to describe, explain, elucidate the experience of being black in America. Understanding the need to acknowledge, validate, and share the experiences, emotions, and thought processes that only another black could understand, the primary intended audience is the African American himself. Some authors, for example, Du Bois, wrote primarily for a white audience, mistakenly thinking that if only they understood the life experiences of another human, different only by skin color, the inhuman treatment would cease.
Well, and so let's talk about what some of the titles are that fit in that category.
First, I think I would offer one that is currently very, very hot to talk about, and that is The Warmth of Other Suns. I recently read that book, and I'm still a bit speechless. In my definition of Black Classics, I have said that it is written for the Black American for that person to understand their own history, their own emotions. It's not uncommon that people have feelings and they don't quite know what to do with those feelings, or they can't explain those feelings. Well, in reading The Warmth of Other Suns, I learned quite a bit about the black experience, the early black experience in this country, especially after World War I and after World War II. For me to learn what it was like to live on a plantation, to be a sharecropper, migrant working, for me to learn to read that history and to learn about that is very valuable. It's valuable for me as old as I am, and it would certainly be a brand new experience. It would be a brand new reality for our youth today.
There is actually another title that is sitting on the table here that you brought with you, and I wonder, this is Michelle Norris's memoir, The Grace of Silence. Would you consider that in that category of black classics?
You know, I think I'm going to say I would, because I learned quite a bit from it. Now, I think her title itself is stirring, The Grace of Silence. Her message in her book is simply that, not simply, but profoundly, that not knowing gives you a measure of comfort. Often there have been tragedies in families that are not spoken of. And if we were aware of those tragedies, I'm not sure that we would be as open and free and caring or giving as some of us are. I think that when people are acutely aware that family members have been lynched, that land has been stolen, that people have been beaten, people have been jailed unjustly, some people are going to be affected by that for the rest of their lives. And so this is where the grace of silence comes in.
Well, it was a remarkable book, and so are all the others that you've mentioned. Carla Allison, it was a delight, and thanks so much for sharing these titles with us.
My pleasure.
Carla Allison is the owner of the Reader's Choice Bookstore on Martin Luther King Drive in Milwaukee. There's a list of the titles she discussed at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. There's also a suggested author list from the Black Classics category she described. You can see the list and hear our discussion about it in the supplemental audio section of our website. Keep listening. A documentary details the problem of homeless LGBT youth in Milwaukee. We'll speak with a filmmaker next on Lake Effect. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Last year, the Cream City Foundation, Milwaukee's leading LGBT organization, piloted a study on youth homelessness on our city's streets each night. The goal of the collaborative project was to document not only how many homeless youth there are, but how many identify as gay or transgender and figure out ways to help that vulnerable population. On the heels of the study, documentary film producer Tess Galoon wanted to present the issue of gay youth homelessness in a more personal, accessible light. Working with students from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Journalism and Mass Communications Department, she set out to record the stories of five homeless LGBTQ youth to document their resilience as they attempted to turn their lives around and to bring attention to their needs. The result is the film Out of Respect, A Story of Five, which will premiere on Thursday in Milwaukee. Galoon tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce more about the project.
A lot of them have been either abused, abandoned, you know, kicked out, or thrown away by parents, by society. And so despite this, they're amazingly courageous and very strong individuals. Just so to see them coming into their own at a critical time in their life, despite not having support and just unconditional love and care as they're growing up, is pretty amazing.
How big of a problem is homelessness among the LGBTQ youth community?
It's huge. I can only speak to it from a standpoint of a documentary filmmaker and educator. There's a lot of organizations that could do a lot better with this, but from what I've learned, I mean, roughly, I believe there's 2 million homeless youth on the streets across the United States. Locally here, HUD did a study, 400 youth are on the streets every night, And out of that, they discovered roughly 20 to 40% are identifying as gay. But those numbers don't justify the reality, because a lot of the youth, either people don't know where they are, or they're not feeling comfortable to come out amongst their peers or youth service agencies. So although the numbers and statistics are important, what people are finding, and Cream City Foundation did a study looking at youth homelessness as an issue, what they realized is that the LGBT youth population have higher risks for everything. Like, they're twice as likely to be severely mistreated by families and the system and society. So they're at higher risk for suicide, drug use, less safe housing options. And when they do find a place, even though there's less options out there, the places they go to are not safe for them. So they end up couch hopping. And when they run out of friends and family that are willing to support them, they're going to places and sleeping on couches in exchange for sex. And it's just, the list goes on and on about the greater risks for this population. So that's the main issue. It's not there's how many more than non-gay youth. That's not what we should be focusing on. It's the fact that this is a problem. It needs to be addressed. It needs to be looked at by families, by youth service agencies, by the education system, and even allies out there. People who are not gay, this is the time to come forward and say, hey, you know what? I'm not comfortable with these conversations. I'm tired of having one form of the population to be discriminated against. That gay joke was not funny. You know, to step forward and help out. You know, we can't do this alone. The gay community can't carry this by ourselves. The next generation is way too important to leave behind, and we're doing that.
And so is this the point where you pick up these five individuals' stories where they've aged out of the system and now they're trying to make it on their own?
Somewhat. Not all of them have aged out. That's the other thing. There's a lot of youth that get kicked out of their home and then just are homeless, and they literally are going from house to couch to couch, sleeping in abandoned buildings, sleeping under bridges, sleeping in the woods. So not all of them actually get into the system. So the five that we followed, and actually, to tell you the truth, I had a hard time finding five individuals that were willing to do this.
Really?
Because the youth has to be able to be ready to come out, because I'm going to talk about this, and here we are today, you know, and so there's going to be exposure. They have to also be willing to be out about being homeless and the abuse and abandonment they've gone through. And then to commit to this, it was a year and a half of time. It's gotten longer, actually, just as we go into distribution and things like that. But that's a long time to remain committed to something and to trust me that I'm going to follow through with them when no one has ever, or very few people have shown that they can be trusted in their lives, and to stay committed. And so we lost several youth initially early on just because we lost contact with them. They didn't have phones. They actually had to move to another home or couch, and so we weren't able to keep in contact. But those, the five that are in the story right now, they're all just coming right off the streets. Four of them were new participants in QBLOC, which is a new local initiative. It's the several youth service agencies have come together to specifically focus on LGBTQ youth and finding them safe housing options, getting them stable, trying to help them get jobs or their GEDs, or you know, just to kind of, let's take a breath, get you guys in a safe place so you can start thinking about your futures. And so four of them were entering that program. And so having that contact with an actual organization allowed me to find them. If their phones were down or, you know, they were kind of lost on the streets for a month, they still were checking in with QBLOC. And so I could kind of access them through that outlet. Otherwise, it's very hard to keep track of a homeless person. Another one of the five was actually entering, working with St. Emilion's Lakeside, which is another youth service agency, and just about to get an apartment. So they, when we met them, they were all on the verge of getting off the streets and into a new housing program of some sort.
It must have taken a tremendous amount to build that trust up with the five that you featured in the film. What did you feel your responsibility was in all of this, not just to the project, but to them?
I immediately wanted them to know that this was their story. Yes, I am a documentary filmmaker, and yes, the students that I was bringing along were going to help me tell this story, but it was very important to me that the five stars know that this is their story, so they need to tell us where to go, what to do, how this should be structured. Obviously, as a documentary filmmaker, I'm responsible for the content and the story to make sure it flows and it's coherent. But this is, you know, their story. And so I wanted them to know that right up front. And so we made a point of meeting with them as much as we could to talk about, here's what we're thinking. We'd like to come and film you at this point. What do you think about that? So we did a lot of that. We also didn't hit them with the hardest questions the first time we met them. We tried to meet with them every 2 weeks, and every 2 weeks we would spend some time talking and interviewing, and then also just spending some time hanging out. You know, what were they doing that day? If we could take the time to do that and then film them, whether they're catching a bus to try to get down to MATC or they're, you know, going for a therapy session up at Pathfinders, we tried to cover as much of their day-to-day life. So we weren't always just putting a camera on them and asking them questions either. The other key thing that I did to try to give them ownership to this was I gave them all cameras, little inexpensive microcams. The audio wasn't that great, but some amazing visuals came out of that. And I think that's the most powerful part of the film is the footage they shot themselves at times we couldn't be there. And I put it in their hands and said, here's some ideas for what you can film, but this is your chance to be creative and give us what you feel is representative of your life, of who you are. And going through all the footage, when I was sitting there doing the edit, the most amazing moments were each of them at one point filmed a close-up of their face struggling with something at one point. And so that's how the documentary opens. And to find all five had done that without me saying anything was like one of those moments like, okay, this was meant to be. The other part of that I want to add was not only was I asking the youth to trust me, but also to trust a group of college students coming from a position of privilege, you know, being in college and having some money to go to college. And so here, a homeless peer, they all were supposed to negotiate together to feel comfortable. I wasn't able to make all the shoots. And so those that I was on, I had felt like I had some control over that. But when I wasn't able to be there, counting on those students to represent, to be professional, but also understanding of the sensitivity of the subject and where they were at. And it was an amazing group of students who only one of them actually was gay. The rest of them were not gay, but they all were very sensitive to the topic. And the biggest struggle for them was to figure out where that line was of being a friend with these youth and then being a professional, you know, trying to be a professional student filmmaker, where we wanted to record their lives and be supportive, but they all started feeling a little bit like, you know, they wanted to do more and they wanted to reach out and offer rides for these young people. And then it started becoming this awkward relationship of sorts of where are we going too far? Now we're affecting their story when we shouldn't be as storytellers.
Right.
And I struggled with that as well constantly. The desire to just want to be their mom and adopt them all and bring them home. I can't tell you how many times I'd come home from a shoot or after spending, you know, hours editing, just wishing I could do more. But I also realized the value of the story getting out there holds the potential to do a lot more than I could just as a adoptive mom.
Well, so then let me ask you, where does, out of respect, this documentary come in terms of helping you and the student filmmakers to do more for the five that you featured in the film?
I'm actually really very hopeful with this story. If we can get enough people to see it, and that's going to be the trick, I actually think you hear all these stories about, you know, social issues or environmental issues, and often you hear them and you think, oh, that's just too big. There's nothing I can really do. What can I do as an individual? This story gives you the tools to be able to feel like I can make a difference. I kind of talked about this a little bit earlier it starts with the family. It starts right at home. And if, especially for those families that lead more sheltered lives or strong religious beliefs, it's time to challenge yourself. It's time to really rethink where your values are and to unconditionally love your child. Your child deserves that, no matter how this child came to you. Then I'm going to challenge the allies in the community. Those of you out there who just kind of are quiet about it or think it's really not your issue because you're not LGBTQ, we need your help. We need you to vote differently. when you get to the voting booth to give, you know, recognize we all deserve the same rights, to speak your mind about what's okay and not okay. And then I'm asking the system itself to rethink how they provide safe or not safe places for these individuals. And so agencies need to have the paperwork. They need to provide special places or group sessions for the LGBT kids. This is the time to take care of. I keep coming back to the phrase, it's like our most precious resource is the next generation. And in that next generation of children, a large percentage of them are gay, are LGBTQ. And this is the time. This has to end. The discrimination needs to stop for this younger generation. I mean, it's hard enough to be an adult and going through this, but no child deserves to not be respected, to not be unconditionally loved by at least one person in their life. This is our future we're talking about here, Milwaukee's future. And I'm just looking at Milwaukee's future. This is in every city across the United States and every country around the world. You know, that's how big it goes. But if I can get Milwaukee to really rethink this next generation and how we're going to help them, that's what I hope this documentary does.
Well, Tuscaloon, thank you so much for coming in and sharing the story of Out of Respect with us.
Thank you for having me and being willing to tackle this with me.
Out of Respect was directed and edited by award-winning documentary producer Tess Galoon, produced by Real Life Films. Galoon also teaches in the Department of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Milwaukee. Production support was provided by students in the UWM JDoc Productions class, including former Lake Effect intern Joel Van Herren. The premiere of Out of Respect is this Thursday evening in the Lubar Auditorium at the Milwaukee Art Museum. You can find out more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Tess Galoon spoke with Stephanie Lecce. One more break, and then a profile of D.A. Wallach, the Milwaukee half of the pop group Chester French. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Begun by two privileged white kids at Harvard and named after the sculptor who created the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, Chester French seems an unlikely band to be embraced by the pop and hip-hop worlds. But that's exactly what happened to David Andrew, or D.A. Wallach, and Max Drummy. The two met at Harvard in 2003 and formed a band. They hit it big before they graduated in 2007, and their music has been heard on the pop charts as well as on TV shows like Entourage. Their first album, Love the Future, was released in 2009, and their second effort, as yet untitled, is scheduled to be released later this spring. Christina Daglis is an assistant editor at Milwaukee Magazine and wrote the story Gentlemen of Rock about D.A. Wallach, the Milwaukee half of the nationally known duo. She explained to Lake Effect's Bonnie North that no one expected David Andrew to become a rock and roll star.
He is your standard, can do it all. He could have been anything he wanted to be. He still could be. And naturally, as those kids are, they're good at everything they do. So he is a brilliant, brilliant student, would have been a wonderful politician. Many people thought that's what he would do. From his drum teacher in high school to his mom and his friends and everyone, they thought he'd be a politician. But he always liked music, and he really started to love music in high school, specifically hip-hop, and he just kept going.
Well, the hip-hop thing is interesting because there's certainly hip-hop influences in the music that they've released so far, but it's not hip-hop.
It's not hip-hop at all.
No, it's very poppy.
And that's why people get so confused, because they hang out with Pharrell and Diddy and all of these hip-hop stars, and yet they're these two little white guys from kind of privileged backgrounds that have nothing to do with hip-hop. And it's a pop sound, but they do have sampling and a little bit of rapping and things like that that's incorporated, which has honestly become really common in music in general. So they're a mix.
Well, the idea that you have the entire sort of black establishment of hip-hop supporting these guys and being, you know, very, very complimentary of their music. I mean, how common is that?
Not. It's an anomaly.
Okay. And so what do you think that's from? I mean, why? Is it because the music is that good?
You know, I'm not sure if it's because the music is amazing. I think that hip-hop musicians and labels can really spot good talent. I don't know that their first album was, you know, on the level of the Beatles or anything like that by any means, but they're talented, talented musicians. I mean, these are guys who can really put together a very catchy song, and I think that the hip-hop community recognizes that and also really appreciates their personalities. And it's more than the skin color, and it's more than the genre of music. I think they just really like them.
Well, talk a little bit about those personalities. There are two guys, and they pretty much do everything.
Oh, yeah. They're completely self-sufficient. And that's actually what they were trying with this album, too. On their first album, they had all of these wonderful friends at Harvard who could play these instruments, and they brought them in and out and had this kind of crazy album with strings players and horns players and all sorts of stuff. And this album, they're like, no, we're just going to do it, the two of us. And it's amazing what they were able to accomplish. But in terms of their personalities, they are very, very different. DA is incredibly gregarious, and you're best friends with him after 2 minutes of conversation. And yet you're trying to interview him, and he's asking you your life story. He's just a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Very social.
Incredibly social. He could talk to a brick wall. he's a really cool guy. Max is also very fun to talk to, but he is sarcastic and hilarious and a jokester, and also very, very serious, as is DA. DA is not a complete, you know, jokester by any means, but when they get down to business, they work, and it's, you know, the joking is done. It's let's record.
Now, the mix of those two personalities is obviously what helps make them successful. It's not just the talent. There's a lot of talented people out there, but is it something about these two guys and what they create together that makes this special?
I think it is. DA is a wonderful marketer, and he is amazing at promotion. So he's the face of the band, for sure, even though it's two guys and it's just them. So theoretically, they could be completely equal and everyone recognize both. But DA is the mouthpiece. He is out there in the forefront. He does all the marketing. He responds to all the fan emails. He does their Twitter account, which is also half of his personal Twitter account, and then also the band's. And has, I don't know, like a million followers, something outrageous. He actually was just named the 24th most influential tweeter in rock music by Rolling Stone a couple weeks ago.
Wow.
So he definitely is talking a lot, and he's saying really interesting things, which goes back to this background at university school and Harvard of just being very well-versed in a variety of topics. And then you have Max, who's just amazingly talented at all these instruments that he plays. He's a multi-instrumentalist. Does everything. So it's an interesting mix where you have the very social, outgoing, very talkative kind of mouthpiece, and then you just have the other guy who's kind of the cute one off to the side that the ladies are all like, oh, Max.
Because he's quiet.
Yeah, because he's the quiet type with, you know, he's mysterious.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, David Andrew also spent some time in the Caribbean as a kid, and how much did that influence the music and what they're choosing to do now?
You know, I think that it influenced more him as a person in terms of diversity and being extraordinarily accepting. Milwaukee is obviously a very segregated city, and that's something that he really became aware of in high school, and I think that became even more present when he was spending his summers in the Caribbean. So I'm not sure about the influence in terms of directly when you listen to She Loves Everybody or something like that. I don't know that you're going to pick up on any kind of Caribbean influences, but it's more the diversity and really kind of fitting in this hip-hop scene that he looks kind of out of place in. Well, she craves affection, so I use protection, and I know she loves me, she loves everybody, maybe.
One of the things you say in your article, which I find very interesting, is that one of DA's litmus tests for a successful song is whether it appeals to someone in high school. Now, that's great if that's where you're skewing in terms of your audience. But what happens to him now? He's what, almost 26?
26.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can't keep talking to high school forever.
No. No, you can't. I think his take on that is that high school students are very impressionable and also very passionate about the music they listen to. So if you can get them there, then perhaps they'll keep listening. But I think the message is going to change. And I don't think that the high school students won't be able to relate to that message anymore, but I do think that he's going to try to skew a little bit older, more in his age range, get some of these 20-somethings to start listening because, you know, the 16-year-old pop isn't going to appeal to that age group, which might be part of the problem in Milwaukee, to be honest.
Well, that leads me right into that question, is that he's got this amazing career, except here.
Yeah.
His hometown pretty much ignores him. And why is that?
You know, I think that there are a number of reasons why that happens here. The Milwaukee music scene is pretty cool. It's vibrant, very, I don't want to say underground, that's so cliche. But it's not mainstream, necessarily. And the music critics really appreciate all different kinds of music, for sure, but they're not necessarily going to jump on the bandwagon of a Danny Gokey or a Chester French. But there is this cultural disconnect where he's from Milwaukee, but he went to Harvard. Who can really relate to that? We don't all go to Harvard. I mean, a lot of us went to UW-Madison or UW-Milwaukee, or, you know, we stay close to home. And he went to University of School Milwaukee, which is a wonderful, wonderful, prestigious high school. And then he went to Harvard. And then all of a sudden he's like, oh, well, I'm from Milwaukee. And I think people are just like, no, you're not. You didn't really do the music here. You just have a house in Fox Point. So I think that there's just this disconnect, and a lot of it is cultural.
Is he hoping to change that, or does he not care?
Oh, he's not giving up. He wants to change that. Okay. He wants people in Milwaukee, just as with every other city in the country, to like the music. He's not just trying to appeal to the LA types, the New York types, or even Chicago. He's determined to get Milwaukee to kind of, not necessarily wholeheartedly embrace it, but at least kind of accept it, which is why he did that Planned Parenthood benefit in the middle of August in a park and was like, sure, yeah, we'll do it. I'll get Max out here. That's why he wanted to come record here, because he loves Milwaukee. He wants to be here.
Well, the new album, which is not yet released, was recorded. It was in Tulsa, right?
Yeah.
It
burst.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I know you've had an opportunity to hear some rough mixes. What are your impressions? And do you think with this new album, he's actually taking steps towards broadening his appeal?
You know, it's a lot different. And he said it himself, that it's the most mainstream music they've ever made. And I think that it's because it's not as jokester, it's not as kitschy. They're not singing about Jimmy Choo's and expensive shoes and things that rhyme and are catchy, and then they can make silly music videos. It's not about that. It's more about the music this time, and really focusing on just good rock songs. And I think that that will have a wider appeal. I mean, I hope that Milwaukee isn't so against it that they won't listen, because that would be a shame, because any good music deserves listening to. But I think that there is a greater chance that with this record, people might give them another listen, another shot.
When's it scheduled to be released?
You know, it's been pushed a little bit. They're saying spring, so we're getting close to that. So we'll see.
Do you know the name? Have they named it yet?
No.
Okay.
Not that I know of.
So we have to watch the Chester French website to find out the release.
Yeah.
Well, Christina, I want to thank you so much for stopping by to talk about this. And we're going to go out with a little bit of Chester French. I think maybe the Jimmy Choo song. What do you think?
I think that sounds good. Thanks for having me. She's got
Jimmy Choo. Christina Daglas wrote the story Gentlemen of Rock about D.A. Wallach, the Milwaukee half of the nationally known band Chester French. It appears in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Daglas spoke with Bonnie North. That's Tuesday's show. Tomorrow, we'll look at the continuum of Wisconsin labor history with the current budget battle in the foreground, plus a Milwaukee woman's memoir of her role in helping a Soviet dissident emigrate to the United States. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10. For Lake Effect, from WUWM and WUWM HD1, Milwaukee Public Radio. Fresh Air is next.